Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So at 1:15 this morning, our dear friend Iris passed away at the age of 66 at her 65. It was 1 year off, 65. So the days and nights are relentlessly passing. How well are we spending our time? And this is, birth and death are just the most ordinary things in the world. That's what unites all of humanity and all beings. And we're all brothers and sisters in birth, aging, sickness, and death. So we're all in the same boat. And this is the destination which just awaits us all. The most ordinary thing in the world. And so Dhamma practice is making provisions for that journey. And that's what we do in our Dhamma practice. That's what we're aiming for. Provisions for the journey we call death. And we say death and we say, oh, that person's dead, but really it's just a transition. There's a moment of death, a moment of passing away, and then there's a transition. And so our Dhamma practice is making provisions for that journey. At the time of death, we have our wholesome and unwholesome actions, our good and bad karma, which we can take with us. Or we could say that the karma, our good or bad karma, takes us with it, pulls us along, leads on. So Iris has been a part of the monastery for about the past 15 years, before I came here. She's been a very regular feature the past decade, especially the past 7 or 8 years. And when I had been here for about 3 or 4 years, I took over the responsibility of book mailing. And at that time, there's this wing on the north side of the Dhamma Hall that used to be our book room. It was before we had built the duplex, which we now know as the book room and nun's day room. So on the north wing of this Dhamma Hall, we had the book room. We kept all of our books in there, and we had the computer in there. So I was in there doing book mailing, sending books to our mailing list. This is before we had a new high-tech website. We had our old website, so we also had a newsletter and we had books and we sent these things out to the people on our mailing list. And also there was a small list of prisoners that we would send books to. We'd get requests from different prisoners and had an Excel spreadsheet that started compiling a list of prisoners in different prisons and chaplains that would receive books from us. And then soon after that, Iris offered to take over the book mailing. And then in the years after that, that list of prisoners and prison chaplains grew to a list of thousands, just a huge list. And Iris just really tirelessly looked after that list and sending just thousands of books over the years to prisoners and just so many letters of gratitude have come in over the years for gratitude for Iris sending those books to them. And this is a Dhamma Dana. This is a very high form of giving, a very giving the opportunity for these prisoners to study, practice the Dhamma. And so over the years that builds up, that good karma. And also however many hundreds of Dhamma talks Iris has done the request for. I know for several years she was requesting almost every talk. So there's no doubt that Iris has ample provisions for her journey. And we can rejoice in that. We can have mudita for that. And just thinking when we do things for others, when we do things that are helpful for others, it's just always wholesome. Selflessness is always wholesome. And we relinquish our own time, relinquish our own desire, what we want to do, and decide to do something that's helpful for somebody else. That's just always wholesome. I can remember when I was Tupansa and working on this water system, tapping the well up at the ridge and then managing a few work crews, two or three different work crews over a period of a couple of months, and just suffering a lot over this project. And after a month, after a month or so, starting to get more and more irritable and feeling that, oh, what am I doing here? That this project, what have I gotten myself into? And then Lungpa Liem visited, and I hadn't been to Thailand yet, but Lungpa Liem came and visited, and Ajahn Pratip, another Thai monk, was living here at the time. And so I remember going and talking to Lungpa Liem one night, helping give foot massage, and Ajahn Pratip was translating and asking Lungpa Liem, what, I've been working on this project, on this water system, and what, I'm just suffering a lot over it. And, you know, I had the idea that I wanted to give dana, give a great service to the Sangha, but at the same time, I'm just getting really angry and suffering a lot over this, and just seem to be completely stuck in my own defilements. And Lungpa Liem, all he said was, if you suffer for the sake of benefiting others, then the happiness that comes back to you is just far greater than anything that you put into that. And that was helpful. And then over the years, just hearing more and more of Lungpa Liem's teachings and teachings from different Krupa Ajahns, and hearing Lungpa Pasano's teachings, and just that emphasis on selflessness. Because so often we get in, you know, work ourselves into a corner where it's me and my practice, and I need to formulate my time in this way. I need to structure my practice in this way so I gain the most benefit for myself. And I don't want to be bothered by other people or other situations that are going to impinge on my practice, capital M, capital P. And it's just a recipe for dukkha. It's just there's never going to be a perfect situation wherever we go. And so the Dhamma practice is much more about relinquishment of our self position, our I or mind position. It's like that story of the Tibetan monk, the young Tibetan monk, who's really sincere, really full of energy, but just can't seem to find contentment or happiness in his practice. And so he goes to his teacher and says, "Well, I've decided that I'm just going to devote my whole time to just walking meditation, and that's it. I'm just going to do walking meditation, just completely focused on just that." And then his teacher's saying, "Well, walking meditation's good, but Dhamma practice is better." And so he kind of doesn't understand that. Goes and he's doing walking meditation, and then kind of his mind's not really calming down. He's really putting forth a lot of energy, but things aren't getting peaceful. There's not contentment there. He decides, goes to his teacher and says, "Well, I'm just going to do sitting practice. I'm just going to sit, you know, as much as I can. Just, I think that's what's going to do it." And his teacher says, "Well, sitting meditation is good, but Dhamma practice is better." And so he goes, sits. He's sitting, really ardent effort. Mind's not really calming down. It's kind of, "Well, what's happening here? I'm really putting a lot of effort into this sitting meditation." So he decides, goes to his teacher and says, "I think I'm just going to do chanting, just nonstop chanting. I'm just going to practice chanting." And so his teacher says, "Well, chanting is good, but Dhamma practice is really better." And so he's kind of, "Oh, what does he mean by that?" He does his chanting practice really tirelessly. Of course, the same thing happens. He's just left kind of scratching his head, wondering why, where's the happiness, where's the contentment? And so he goes to his teacher. He's kind of like, "Well, what is this Dhamma practice you keep talking about?" And his teacher just says, "Well, you just have to just relinquish this life. That's Dhamma practice." And so it's not about finding what's right for me or the exact right method or the exact right practice, but it's relinquishing that self position and being very flexible and selfless. So we're a month into the winter retreat now. It's February. And we've had a fairly open schedule for the past week. After the meal, the entire afternoon has been open, apart from today, not having to come down for evening puja. Tea, coming down for tea is optional. So we've had an open period to experiment with sitting meditation, walking meditation. Some people might be studying suttas. And these are all incredibly wholesome activities. But when we have an open schedule like this, an open afternoon, better part of the day is open, the mind has a way of filling up the space with proliferation, and then it can seem like we're doing a lot of things, and it seems like we're really busy and we're doing a lot. And if we really take stock and see, how much am I doing each day? It's not very much. But the mind can make it seem like a lot. The mind has a way of filling up the space and making things seem confused, but there's really not much happening on an external level. Most of what's happening is just the mind just churning out its incessant mental proliferation. So if we really look what's happening, it's we have a morning chanting, morning meditation. Morning chores, breakfast, retreat crew is preparing the meal. We have meal cleanup. And that's it. Whoever's doing tea, we have tea preparation in the evening. And that's it. There's not much more than that. So if the mind is quiet, then this isn't a burden. But once the I, me, and mine position comes up and takes hold, then it'll be like, well, it's still not enough. I need more, I need more, I need more. Or whatever voice is going on in the mind, discontent. And this is dukkha, this is the first noble truth. And the tendency is to want to run away from it. But dukkha is just very ordinary. It's to be seen, it's to be understood. And to be learned from, we can really learn from the dukkha, from the discontent that's arising for us. What sort of craving and attachment is there? What's causing that dissatisfaction in the mind, in the heart? I remember when I was in Anagarika, but a much, much smaller community then, and it started happening that almost every day everybody would trickle out of the kitchen and I'd be by myself doing dishes until 1 p.m. or 1:30 on a daily basis. And I was never very good at asking for help or demanding help. Or trying to get people to help me, so I would just kind of not say anything as people just trickled off or had other commitments, had to do other things. And so the majority of the time, I would be alone, washing, rinsing, and drying all the dishes. And if it's just one person in there, it takes quite a long time. And from time to time, Debbie would come in and say, "Anagarika Leaf, they abandoned you again." And she said that many times on many different occasions. I'm sure she remembers. and so then Ajahn Kurdadamo came in one day and he said, "You know, you need to really develop that skill of being able to ask for help. And that's really important. And so, you know, if you're by yourself doing dishes for a long time, you know, you should be, you know, don't feel shy to go and ask the bhikkhus or lay people, you know, to help you out." And so the next day it happened again. I was alone in there. So then I went and I was going to see if the bhikkhus could help me out. But then it was like, "Oh, you're an Anagarika. You shouldn't be asking the bhikkhus for help. That's quite inappropriate." So then I felt quite sad and dejected after that. But then my attitudes started to change and shift as well, because you know, I started to think, like, there's this sutta where the Buddha talks about, he says, if a man were pierced by 3 spears in the morning, 3 spears in the afternoon, and 3 spears in the evening, run through with spears, and it's incredibly painful, and if by some chance he wasn't killed by those spears, but was just inflicted with incredible pain, and that same thing happened to that person every single day for 100 years, and if by undergoing that immense amount of pain, one would realize the Four Noble Truths based on that pain, then I say that would be worth it for that person. And yet, to realize the Four Noble Truths, you don't even have to be run through by a single spear. It's merely the practice and effort of the contemplation and the practice of virtue, concentration and wisdom, sila, samadhi, panya, that will lead to the realization of the Four Noble Truths. So it's that much more worth it to put the efforts into the practice. And so I started thinking like that and thinking, well, if this small amount of suffering of doing dishes by myself for a few hours every day, if that's all I have to do to enter into the Buddha's teaching, then this is a luxury. This is more than worth it. And Ajahn Acholo was living here at the time, and I think Ajahn Jodhipalo might have had something to do with this too. We have this chant on the 4 Brahma Viharas of spreading loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity to the 4 quarters of the world. And part of the chant is it goes, abundant, exhausted, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, but they had the new rendition, which was abandoned, exhausted, and miserable. Just more like an accurate description of my life as an anagarch. But it really develops these qualities of patience and just a willingness to be able to go into dukkha rather than run away from it. A really important quality for practice. And later on, going to Thailand, just over and over again, Lungpor Liam putting that emphasis on dukkha is something you just have to face dukkha and go into it, and that's the practice. And it takes courage, but it's also incredibly rewarding. Just seeing dukkha in the heart, and instead of running away, just looking right at it. Where is that coming from? What's happening there? Using mindfulness to investigate it, diving into it. And the mind will try to say, well, it's this situation, this person, that person. But if the attitude changes just slightly, then situations or people which rub us the wrong way, those turn into our greatest teachers, and we have a very genuine gratitude for those situations and people which seem to be a cause for that dukkha to arise. And we start to get a sense, well, what is this dukkha? Where does it come from? What's the cause? We start to get a sense that it's very much related to this self position, me is a real problem, really gets in the way of contentment, happiness, and peace. And that's ignorance. That's the positing of a sense of self. Like Lungpur Samedo would say, like, ignorance just complicates everything. Or whenever Lungpur Samedo would, and it would be hard to believe somebody of his stature saying something like this, but he would say, just whenever I think of myself, I get depressed. And yeah, he's someone who doesn't have much to be depressed about, having lived an incredibly wholesome life, just devoted to service and selflessness. And we start to learn that there's a real joy and happiness that comes about when we do forget ourselves for the sake of others or for the sake of the Dhamma. If we forget ourselves for the sake of the practice, that's much different than me practicing Dhamma. It's more like stepping aside so that the Dhamma can be the practice. Or like an illustration of that is on this trip to Canada with Lungpur Liam and Ajahn Jandi, Ajahn Yanadamo, and my father was driving one of the rental cars up to, we did a road trip from here to Birkin and had various stops along the way. And my father having a exchange with Ajahn Yanadamo and having kind of a Dhamma exchange, question and answer. And my father's name is Jan, so he's my Ajahn Yanadamo saying, well there's only one person telling my father, there's only one person standing in your way, and his name is Jan. And then my dad came and told me about it, and he said he had this image of himself standing in his own way. I thought that's quite good. That's how it is in the practice. It's just us standing in our own way, providing our own blocks for ourselves. It's a real blessing too, living in community, just being given the opportunity to hear teachings on a regular basis and to learn these things. And I think various times already during this retreat, different people have mentioned anecdotes about, people asking the Dalai Lama, what is the fastest way to enlightenment? And he had his answer for that. And or somebody asking Ajahn Chah, what is the fastest way to enlightenment? And Ajahn Chah saying, point your finger directly at your mind and just say, liar. But when somebody asked Lungpur Samedo, what's the fastest way to enlightenment? He said, living in community is the fastest way to enlightenment. Forces you to let go, or else you're just miserable. But if you let go, you're not miserable. It's about letting go. It's all about letting go. So just learning to let go. And it's actually really difficult for the heart to learn this. So I think it just takes a long time for almost anybody. Even these readings I was doing from Lungpur Liam at the beginning of the winter retreat, and he's talking about his own practice and his seemingly very quick development in his practice. But what he doesn't mention in that talk is he had already been a monk for 7 years when he went to Wat Pa Phong. And so he's talking about, the beginning of his time at Wat Pa Phong, but yeah, he had already he had already been practicing for 7 years. And so even for somebody of his stature, it didn't happen immediately or instantaneously. And so it's good to understand the context of these things. And even in the suttas and in the commentaries, for some monks it took an incredibly long time to break through to the Dhamma. The Venerable Ratapala, they say 14 years. They have these phrases in the suttas, you know, so he takes the teaching of the Buddha and goes off and practices in solitude, and quote-unquote, after no long time, he attained arhantship. And so with, you know, there's that phrase with Venerable Ratapala, and it's, then the commentary says, well, this means 14 years in his case. He practiced for 14 years, and that's after no long time. In the big scheme of things, that is after no long time. You know, if you think about the beginningless time in samsara and the endless round of rebirths of... I like this phrase Ajahn Jeff uses, rebirth and re-death. Rebirth and re-death over and over again. And then there's other monks. It's just, there's the monk who, he's been practicing for 25 years and he claims he hasn't had a moment of peace. And so he's just going to hang himself. He's just going to kill himself. And so he has the noose around his neck, and then he reflects that he's never transgressed a major precept. And just the bliss and joy from that reflection so strong that he achieves arhantship right then and there with a noose around his neck, and then utters these verses, which we find in the Tathagata now. So that's 25 years. There's a monk in the commentary who didn't break through to the Dhamma until he'd been practicing for 60 years. And so it really depends on, everybody has different kama, different parami, different accumulated spiritual virtues. And so it's just to have that faith to stick with the practice and to know that these results do come. And certainly these bhikkhus in the past stuck with it and the results came. And we have we're studying the Thai forest tradition and doing readings from different Thai forest masters for the winter retreat. And so all of these ajahns also had their own periods of time. Some of them it took a long time to break through, and some it was not as long as others. And sometimes it can just, I mean, there'll be times for everybody where it just seems impossible. Again, I remember one of these massage sessions with Lumpur Liam, where I had opportunity to ask him some questions. And this is during my 7th Pansa. I spent Pansa at Wat Bapong. Just saying, Lungpa, it just seems like it's impossible to give up certain desires and attachments. It just seems impossible. And of course, he said, it's like, Ben by die, it's possible, you know, you can do it. And then just giving encouragement. So there's just times when it just seems impossible. But that's when we just develop patient endurance and we just wait and see the things change. The mental states always change. Sometimes it changes, it gets worse. Sometimes it changes, it gets better. But it always changes. I like this one quote too from I can't remember who it is, but it's some famous American World War II like a battleship captain, and he said that, you know, if things are difficult, well, we can do difficult things. If it's impossible, it might just take a little bit longer. And so. So taking that attitude in practice, if it's impossible, it's just going to take a little bit longer. Just give it some time. Just keep working away at it. and never give up. And so we're just living the life, living the holy life, whether we're a monk or a nun or a layperson. Yeah, we just have these various ways we can practice the Dhamma, and we can be practicing relinquishment. We have generosity. We have these factors of effort and contemplation. And over time, we can take these to increasing levels, and our understanding can begin to deepen. So I personally find it incredibly helpful listening to all these talks of Krupa Ajahn's, because all of them coming at the Dhamma in very similar ways, but from their own experience and from slightly different angles. And it's just so helpful to see those different facets of the Dhamma and how it expresses itself in so many different ways. And yet there's these threads that run through it. There's those threads of energy, effort, patient endurance, these threads of not getting stuck in just mere concentration or tranquility of mind, but really bringing forth the contemplations, bringing forth the Dhamma teachings and gaining insight. Not being content with just mere peace, but bringing the practice to a higher level, deeper level. There's a thread running through it of mere book study isn't enough, so it has its place. I think all of these Ajahn's would have done some book study, but then you have to walk the path, you have to do the practice, you have to sit on your cushion and do the meditation, you have to get out on the Chogram path and walk meditation. We have to cultivate the sense restraint. The sense restraint is essential for the meditation. If the mind is just proliferating about various sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touches, coming up with good ideas, work projects, things to do, etc., then the mind's not going to be peaceful. The meditation's not going to deepen. And so the sense restraint is not necessarily a tightness, but it's seeing that this is how we make the mind peaceful, this is how it works. So whether you're a monastic or a layperson, the sense restraint is just essential for deepening the meditation practice. And it's in the phrase in the suttas, he sees a form with the eye, not giving rise to its signs and features. Hearing a sound with the ear, not giving rise to its signs and features, not proliferating about it, not hankering after it, not craving it. With the meal, the taste, not giving rise to its signs and features. And so the mind is clean, the mind is pure. And going back to one's kuti in the afternoon, when we have this open period and sense of peace and brightness. And the mind needs an anchor, so we need that meditation object too. That's another thread that runs through these teachings of the Krupa Ajahn's. The mind has to have an anchor, so a lot of them are teaching butto, but with the in-breath, to with the out-breath, reciting it in the mind. Lungpa Cha teaches that, but also just noticing the sensation of the breath at the tip of the nose. So the mind has to have an anchor. It's an essential part of the practice. Virtue, the sila, just good conduct, true conduct. Just our actions are clean, straightforward. Ujjupatipanno, practicing in a straightforward way. Everything's out in the open. We're straightforward and gentle in speech. We're practicing noble silence during the winter retreat. I noticed when we confess our offenses at Padimokkha, had no offenses that I could recall, and I think that's largely because of the noble silence. We just commit if we see things in terms of the Padimokkha Sila, in terms of the 227 monks precepts, how many offenses we commit just through speech. And that when we're practicing noble silence, only speaking when necessary, it just cuts out a whole subsection of a little bit more coarse conduct. So our conduct is clean and straightforward and bright. And that has a real effect on the mind. And then the wisdom aspect, I think Tanajan Mahabua is a real strong on this aspect. For me, when I read his teachings, that really comes through very strong. And the not-self, the wisdom of not-self. Yeah, letting go of a I, me, or mine position. Just heading in that direction. You know, the mind becoming quiet. Just to end, something that was coming up really strongly for me today, and it relates to Iris with her Dhamma Dana, and just that sense of being selfless and doing things for others. And I was thinking a lot about Master Xuan Hua, the late abbot of City of 10,000 Buddhas, and when he was 19 years old and his mother passed away, and he then set up a teepee next to his mother's grave and practiced just incredible austerities for 3 years, meditating next to his mother's grave in order they say in the Chinese tradition that he said would say to cross over his mother, but in our jargon we would say to share the blessings, share the merit with his mother. And for me, that's a very powerful contemplation, thinking of Master Xuan Hua doing that, because he wasn't going in that teepee just thinking, I'm going to go do my practice. He was doing it for his mother. And I have a strong sense that that's the only reason he was able to do that, is because he wasn't doing it for himself. And so I'd like to just end with that thought that, you know, when we do things for ourselves, we really, when it's all about us, when it's all about me, we really limit ourselves with that view. And when we really take it on to forget ourselves for the sake of others, that's true. That's good practice. That's supatipanno. That's good practice right there. So I'll just leave that for reflection this evening.